This is Sci-Fi for Me.
On the phone with R.A. Salvatore, author of several novels in the Dungeons & Dragons and Forgotten Realms. The new book, Neverwinter, which is book two of the Neverwinter saga, it drops on October 4th, published by Wizards of the Coast, and features a character that many are familiar with from all of these different novels, the dark elf Drist. And he's got a new companion. We're picking up where the second book where the first book left off, rather. Is Drist a favorite character of yours? Is that why we keep seeing him show up in these books?
No, he started out as a sidekick character, actually. I mean, he wasn't even in the original outline for the Crystal Shard back in 1987 when I was writing it. And it turned out I needed a sidekick. I had to come up with one quick, and off the top of my head, I came up with a dark elf named Dritstewarden. And they said, okay, they'd let me get away with writing a dark elf character, because at that time, dark elves were just monsters. They weren't considered, you know, good guys in any way. They let me get away with writing it because it was just a sidekick. But when I started writing the book, I was about three pages in, and I knew it was his book. There was a connection there immediately between me and this character. And I think he really sealed the deal. A few years later, I had written six books, including the three detailing his origins, where he came from and how he got to where he was, and he kind of sealed the deal with me at that point. So yeah, he's an absolute favorite character of mine. He is as much my favorite character as Sherlock Holmes was Conan Doyle, Arthur Conan Doyle's favorite character. I mean, I have to admit that.
I was talking to David Weber a while back about the Honor Harrington series, and the topic came up of the fact that Honor Harrington was supposed to die at one point in the storyline, and because the character has gotten to be so popular, David really couldn't do that. Have you ever contemplated the death of Drist? I mean, is he somebody that's going to stick around no matter what, or do you have a death scene written in some tucked away somewhere?
I do. I almost went through it at one point, but they wouldn't have let me when back in the mid 90s I was breaking up very painfully with TSR over some creative differences. You know, I'm writing the story. I'm almost afraid that it will happen, because if the story tells me to do it, I'll do it. I'm not planning out that far ahead so that I can say it will happen. And I'm hoping it doesn't. Just like I was hoping a lot of the other characters wouldn't go away, other characters who have gone away. And, you know, at this point, I treat this series as if I'm walking down a road with these characters and they're telling me what's going on. It's as much fun for me writing the books as it is for people reading the books, because I really don't know what's going to happen page to page. But yeah, I have. At one point, I almost did it. At one point, I really wanted to do it, not because I was sick of the character, but because I knew that after I got pretty much thrown out of TSR, that they were going to have other people writing the character, and that was worse to me. So, it could happen.
So, what can you tell us about the new book? He meets Dahlia, who's another elf, and he's dealing with the fallout from the last book, the Cataclysm at Mount Hutnow. What can you tell us about this new book? Where are we going in this one? And how many books do you see in the Neverwinter Saga storyline?
Well, the Neverwinter storyline, I don't ever think of the books in terms of trilogies. To me, it's just the next logical step for the character. I try to make each book self-contained so that it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. You can read one without having read the previous ones, although I hope you'll go back and start at the beginning. But they're planned three books for this arc. That has to tie in with the video game that's coming out, Neverwinter Nights 3. I'm not sure when it's coming at this point. So I'm writing on two levels here. One level is that I'm writing books to set up the video game. Not writing the story of the video game, but I'm writing books to leave that region of the Forgotten Realms in the shape that Cryptic Studios wants it in so they can do the video game. But that's kind of the macro dressing level you know, cake frosting level. And the really interesting thing that this story's allowed me to do is, for all of the years I've been writing Drizzt, other than his first book in Menzo Berenzan, he surrounded himself with characters who were of like heart. People who would jump in front of him to take an arrow aimed for his heart, like he would save them with his own life. You know, his friends were people of similar morals. And now, all of a sudden, he's surrounded by people who really don't share his moral code. And so the question is, do they bring him down, or does he bring them up, or is it a combination of the two? And I don't even know the answer to that, which is why I'm having so much fun writing it.
Now, is that something that you've done before, writing with a specific goal in mind that deals with another tie-in, whether it's a video game or a graphic novel? You've got a specific destination that you have to arrive at in order for another piece to fall into place in the right way?
Yeah, that's been going on forever and ever with Forgotten Realms, because it's a shared world. So I have to constantly be aware of what they're doing when they put out new editions of the Dungeons & Dragons game, because this is home base for the Dungeons & Dragons game. So when they make changes, like many, many years ago, they had a thing called the Time of Troubles, when they went from first edition to second edition, Dungeons & Dragons. There were many changes made in the world and in the game, and the books had to reflect those changes in some way. And again, they let me, I'm not writing the core stories for this, so I don't have to worry about all the exact details. I just have to put the flavor right in the books for the changes. But yeah, that's been going on. That's the nature of shared world. It's something you have to be able to do. Because if you didn't have that, you'd have, you know, the novels would become so disjointed, and the game products would become so disjointed that there would be no immersion for the fans. They would have no, you know, there'd be no sense of this is the way the world is over all these different products. So yeah, I mean, I've been, many, many times I've started writing a book and I've gotten that phone call saying, well, this is what's going on in that region at that time. Is there some way you can incorporate some of these things, at least as side stories?
Do you find that writing franchise tie-ins is easier than doing original pieces, or is it just different?
Because, you know, in the end, you're writing about characters that people are going to care about or not care about. And so, you know, whether I'm writing my own books like Demon Wars or Spearwheeler's Tale or Crimson Shadow or some of the other series I've done, you know, The Highwayman, whether I'm writing these books or I'm writing Forgotten Realms, the characters are what matters. The characters are the things that are going to make the people relate to the story. And then, other than that, I mean, is it harder for me to sit down and create a world out of whole cloth that has a distinctive magic system? Or is it harder to write within the constraints of somebody else's magic system? They're different skill sets to some extent, but I wouldn't say one is harder than the other, and that the creativity level is certainly, as much as a shared world can kind of hem you in, it can also give you inspiration. So it all evens out. And I don't find one harder than the other.
You mentioned The Highwayman and Demon Wars. The Highwayman is not part of a series, and it's one of the few that you've written that was just a standalone by itself book. Are we spoiled for trilogies now because of films not being a single film? We go in, you know, Back to the Future and Avatar and Harry Potter and all of these different films that are out there that have us, are we spoiled for sequels now?
I don't think it's even for the reason you state, but yeah, I think we are. But it's more got to do with the fact that a publisher is going to have a hard time building the kind of audience that makes it profitable on a single book. And the publishers know that, and that's why they want 3, 4, or whatever, or unending series. And The Highwayman, you say The Highwayman was a standalone book. But I've written 3 more. The Highwayman is a standalone book. You don't have to read anything after The Highwayman, but I wrote The Ancient, The Dame, and the Bear following The Highwayman, because I grew interested in the character. So, and it's the same thing I say with the Dritz books. You know, you can pick up The Thousand Orcs and read it. You can pick up The Lone Drow and read it. You don't have to read the whole series. In a way, I'm doing more like Sherlock Holmes or James Bond than I am The Wheel of Time or Song of Ice and Fire, where those books really build into the next book, build into the next book, build into the next book. You can't pick up the 10th book of The Wheel of Time and read it and have any idea what you're reading.
Right.
But you can pick up the 10th book of the Dritz series and read it because it's a single book. But yeah, people, because there are so many choices, because, you know, there are 500 channels on your TV and there are 120,000 books published each year, you have to create something bigger than the individual novel now, it seems like, especially in genre fiction, to keep going. And that's why you have so many, you know, detective series focused on one character and fantasy series focused on one world or one group of characters. And is it a good thing or a bad thing? And I'm not sure. I think at times it is a bad thing. You know, are we ever going to have a Catch-22 again or a, you know, Slaughterhouse-5? Or will we then have to go on and read the continuing adventures of Billy Pilgrim in Slaughterhouse-6 or something? You know?
Right. Now, is electronic publishing having an impact on that as well? Because a lot of franchise bits now, you're having novels and graphic novels, comic books, video game tie-ins, merchandising. How much of an impact do you think that's having on the publishing industry? Are we seeing everything being influenced by what else can be sold, or are they just finding something?
I'll tell you, I'm looking at my backlist very carefully now, and I just did an analysis because I track all my numbers. I like to know the trends out there. And if I go back over the last 3 years, the top level numbers of the individual titles is very similar. It's within a few percent one way or the other, so it's stable. But ebooks have gone from 2% to 19% to 41%. Mm. Of my backlist sales over the last 3 years.
Wow.
That's huge. And I think there are going to be a lot of repercussions that come out of that. And most of them, in the end, maybe seem negatively. I'm not sure yet, but here's a couple of things I think are going to happen. You're going to have tons of self-publishing. You already do. And without the filter of the publishers, that can be a really devastating thing to readers. Now, I'm not saying that people who self-publish shouldn't be published. That's not what I'm saying. It's not. But the fact is, without that filter kind of narrowing it down, the idea that you're going to be reading a book one of your friends is also reading becomes very minimal.
Right.
Because there's so many choices. That may be too many. It's not like music, where you can listen to a song in 3 minutes. You know, to read a book is a multi-hour investment of time. And so, with that filter of the publishers, you know, the publishers used to be the ones who used to get the 1,000 manuscripts, narrow it down to a few that they think should be published. Were they always right? Absolutely not. I mean, you know, Dune was rejected 13 times before it finally got published, and Dune is arguably one of the top two or three science fiction books of all time. I mean, brilliant work, and it was rejected. So they don't always get it right. There are lots of people who don't get published who should. But there are also lots of people who haven't polished their craft enough who are going to be published now, self-publishing. And so you'll find, you know, tremendous grammatical, spelling, sentence structure, logic mistakes in a lot of self-published books because they're not getting the editorial support they need. They don't have the editors helping them hone their craft. I mean, my biggest learning experience as a writer didn't happen in college. It happened when I wrote The Crystal Shard, and I had an editor on the phone with me for 15 hours straight beating the ever-loving tar out of me. That's what editors bring, and the editors are being lost in the shuffle now. Because people who are self-publishing, you know, oh, I wrote this book and I want to publish it. You know you're not going to make a lot of money even though you've published it. Are you going to spend $5,000 to go hire an editor?
Right.
Probably not.
Now,
so
is that...
there's a lot of pitfalls. And the other thing that scares the heck out of me with the electronics is that I really believe that content's going to be shrunken down. I think short stories are going to come back strong. But they're going to be just pieces of a bigger story, not the crafted short stories of a James Joyce, but just pieces of a bigger story, because people are going to be looking for those microtransactions. What can I do and put out there for 99 cents?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I think there are potential pitfalls. In the end, it should wash out, and it should find the best model, and I have faith that the best model will also be the best model for creativity and for storytelling. But I'm scared.
Well, now, what kind of an impact do you think that electronic publishing is going to have on libraries? I mean, we see what's happening with the U.S. Postal Service, you know, having trouble staying solvent because of email and FTP servers and that sort of thing. Are we going to see libraries at some point become a thing of the past? I know that's a big thing, a big passion for you. And
yeah, I'm glad you asked that. Actually,
is it where are libraries going to be in the 21st century? I mean, are they relics now?
They're not relics now, but they certainly are becoming more and more like a computer hub for people who can't afford the internet or computers of their own. They're becoming more video based. People go to libraries to borrow movies all the time. I mean, the number of videos that you're seeing going out is just huge. There'll still be places where people go to do research. I think that vibrant libraries have to have lots of adult and children's programming to bring people together, almost in a community center type of way, either with, you know, adult learning centers and children's story hour and concerts even. In a lot of the libraries now, you're seeing, you know, them having musical. So a lot of new libraries will have auditoriums in them. Ours does. I was recently out in a couple of years ago on book tour. I was out in Cerritos, California, and they have this absolutely amazing library. I don't know how much it cost, but it was in the tens of millions. It is just beautiful. It's more like a museum than a library. And they had something like 180 public access computer stations in that library.
Wow.
So they're going to adapt. They're not relics yet, but they certainly, when we get through the next wave of building, and even if the money's there, even if public financing, you know, people stop believing in public financing of things again, which I hope they do, the libraries that are built now and 10 years from now are not going to look like the book warehouses of the 1960s or the, you know, the Carnegie buildings that were built in around the turn of the 20th century. They're going to be very different. I mean, you're going to be seeing people going in there with their Kindles and borrowing books by holding them up to a little dot on the wall and just downloading. You're already seeing that.
Right.
Again, well, good or bad, I don't know. It is. So we adapt and we go on, right?
Well, yeah, some of us. I mean, I myself consider myself a dinosaur. I'm still a real big fan of hardcover books, you know, books that you can hold in your hand and movies that are shot on film. So I'm in the minority still.
I've never read a book on a computer screen except for my own in the rewrite process.
Now, has that changed a lot with electronics now that in that process of finishing a book? I know you probably type it out on a computer or you dictate it in some software that writes it out for you. And then your process then in the editing standpoint, you're not getting anything from the editors in the mail, you know, in a big envelope with a bunch of marks on it. You're getting something electronic.
Right.
Has that made it easier?
Absolutely, it makes a difference. And, of course, if you're not careful, you can start to wonder, wait a minute, which version is this? Is this the edited version or the unedited version? You know, you have to be very, very careful when you have multiple versions working. The good thing is now that a lot of the word processing programs like MS Word have a bubble, note bubble section that you can put in. So you're getting red marked manuscripts back now. For a while, we didn't have that. And so, you know, people would, well, I bolded all the parts I think should be changed or something, or any words I changed. I bolded them, so you'll find them. And it's amazing, though, because even with one of the problems is you can become too reliant upon, for the author, you can become too reliant upon spell checker. So you're not reading carefully enough to catch the H-T-E instead of T-H-E, assuming the spell checker will catch it, and it doesn't catch them all. And then for the editors, sometimes they get too into this grammar checker thing. And the grammar checkers make me insane because there are times when books are not grammatically correct by the hard and fast rules on purpose because we're doing things for effect. A sentence fragment that stands as its own paragraph is not going to pass a grammar checker. But that sentence fragment that's standing as its own paragraph is only there so that I can get the reader a little closer to the edge of his or her seat.
Right.
It's done on purpose. And a writer knows to use the rules of the English, knows that all the punctuation and all the capital letters and all the rules of the English language are really tools for communication. A grammar checker thinks they're hard and fast rules. There's a difference. And you can lose a lot of that if you start becoming reliant on technology, because technology doesn't understand that difference.
Now, speaking of keeping readers on the edge of their seats, Vector Prime. Do you still get questions? Do you still get flack about being the writer who killed Chewbacca? I mean, I know you were working under orders, but how did that feel when they told you, okay, you're going to kill off a major character in the Star Wars universe?
Well, I can't repeat what I said. Again with an F. When they told me it was Chewbacca, they didn't tell me it wasn't. I mean, it went down like this. They asked me to come aboard and do a book because they needed to get a book out before Christmas was the thing. They had just won the license from Bantam. Del Rey had just won the license. It was a huge license. They needed to get a Christmas book out. I was working for them doing my Demon Wars series. I was also writing Dritz books, but they knew I'm a very fast and clean writer. And what I mean by clean is that my books come in, the change between the manuscript I send the publisher and the final book that goes out is never more than a couple of percent. I'm a clean writer.
Mm-hmm.
Get it right the first time, or I get it the way I want it the first time. So they knew I could write it quickly. They called me up in like August and asked me to come aboard. I got permission from Wizards of the Coast to delay the book I owed them because they thought it would be great exposure for me to do a Star Wars book, and they knew I really wanted to do it. And then I came in, I signed the contract, I got the advance, I put it in the bank, you know, the advance check. I came up with this big outline, I sent the outline in from all the information they had sent me, and I'm on the phone with Lucasfilm and Del Rey, and Sue Rostoni, or maybe it was Lucy Wilson from Lucasfilm, says, this is great, this is exactly what we're looking for, but didn't anyone tell you? You have to kill Chewbacca. And that's when I dropped an F-bomb, and but they convinced me that they were doing it for the right reasons, so I agreed to do it.
Any regrets?
Yeah, tons.
Yeah.
Honestly, tons of regrets. I'm not sure they made the right choice. I know why they were doing it. I know what they felt the series needed. But what do you say to a 40-year-old guy who comes up to you and starts crying because you took away, and he used to sleep with his Chewie doll when he was a kid?
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to a guy like that? And he's not crazy. This was an important part of his childhood that was taken away, and you could argue for marketing reasons. I don't think it was that. I think it was for creative reasons. But so yeah, tons of regrets. I mean, knowing what I know now about the reaction to it, if they had called me and asked me to do it, I probably would say no. Not only would I say no, I would argue against it. Get death threats and stuff? No. But would I I do get is I get people at book signings who say their brother was going to come, but he wouldn't because he hates me because I killed Chewbacca.
Well, hopefully you won't deal with the same fallout if that ever happens with Drizzt.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have no answer to you. It was a tough time. It was doubly tough because that book came out right when my brother passed away.
Oh.
And so I'm dealing with that on a real level, and now I'm dealing with death threats about a fictional character's death at the same time. It was a very, very strange... 1999 was very, very strange for me.
The next book, Neverwinter Saga, Book 2. Yep. R.A. Salvatore, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate you talking with us today. Good luck with the book.
Very welcome. Thanks for your interest.
All right. We will talk to you soon, and looking forward to reading the book.
This has been a presentation of SciFiForMe.com.